My name is Miriam Hoffman. I am a professor at Columbia University. I teach Yiddish, Yiddish literature, Yiddish culture. I have many students, especially in the beginner's class. I'm talking over 20. And most of them, interestingly enough, are modern Orthodox. So it's much easier with them. And they're really into finding out what is it all about. Yiddish language, Yiddish culture. Although they're modern Orthodox, they're interested. They really are not knowledgeable in the culture, in the literature, even in the customs and traditions. I have to remind them or introduce them to them. My intermediate classes are not as full because some of them register in their last year when they're seniors, and so they finish, and others get married, and others stay. So those that stay are with me in the intermediate class, and they can be between 8 and 10 students. The advanced Yiddish class consists of less. It could be 5 or 6, because these are graduate students working on their MAs or PhDs in Yiddish language, linguistics, folklore, literature, theater, music. So these are classes that are not as full as the first class. I've been teaching there at Columbia for almost 20 years, and I don't feel like retiring. I love it, I really love it, and my students love me, and that really keeps me going. What I do with the Workman's Circle, well, if I'm invited, I come and I give a course in Yiddish, Yiddish literature, Yiddish grammar, and introduce them to Yiddish poets and writers. And everything is new for them, for this audience. This is an elderly audience. Interestingly enough, it depends. They know a little Yiddish. But it depends what Yiddish schools they attended when they were children. A lot of them, a great number of them, attended lefty school, you know, communist schools. They have no idea that Yiddish has a lot of Hebrew in it, sacred tongue, Aramaic. So they were not taught the Hebrew element in Yiddish, only phonetically. So they spell Shabbos, Shin, Aleph, Beis, Ayin, Samach. And it's very hard for them to read a piece of literature which is not phonetically spelled as the communist Soviets used to spell it. And I explained it to them. There was an ideology connected to this spelling, because slowly, slowly, they would wean away the Jews from the Hebrew element, from the religion, of course, that was the idea. And in the end, kill it, like they did in Soviet Union, you know. Either schools were closed, press was closed, synagogues were gone, Yiddish life was finished, Yiddish theater was finished, and so on, under the Soviets. So it's all new for them, which is quite interesting. Well, anything that I bring is new. Many audiences that didn't go to shulis at all are ignorant of their culture. They have no idea what we created in our 2,000-year exile. No idea. And if we talk of politics of Zionism, And I explained to them that Yiddish is a very unfortunate language because it was hit over the head, bombed over their head all through its life. First it was the religious that said, oh, it's in competition with our holy language, with our sacred tongue. It might do us harm. We might forget. And the sacred tongue in exile was spoken, or in their prayers, in their attending the shul and services. So that's where Lushan Kodesh, which is sacred tongue, lived. Outside of the synagogue, it didn't. It was a dead language, Hebrew. Yiddish was the language alive and full of vitality and development and creativity. So that was the first competition, Hebrew, and not Hebrew, but sacred tongue with Yiddish. Second competition came with Zionism. Now the Zionists had an ideology, back to Zion, back to Israel, get away from the exile, it's ugly, get away from religion, it's ugly, get away from the Golas Yid, which is the Jew in exile. He was an ugly, bearded, earlocked, strimal Jew. We don't want that in our land when we will be established as a state. So they cut off their noses. They got rid of 2,000 years of creativity, of exile. But you can't get rid of a Rashi and a Rambam and a Vilna Goyen and a Sholem Aleichem and everything that we created in Golis, in exile. We survived as a people because of the exile. And this is the second time in our history that we survived as a people because of exile. The first time was in Babylonia. If not for Babylonia, we would have disappeared completely.
What is the saying in Yiddish? It's to be a Yid is in Galus.
Well, in among the German Jews, it was Zaya Yid in Hoys, be a Jew at home, una Menschen Gas, and a person outside in the street, a man in the street, dressed like the Germans, speak like the Germans, think like the Germans, culturally and so on, like the Germans. But you see, with the German Jews, they assimilated to such a degree that they almost disappeared. And if they ever thought that Hitler is going to spare them because they are German Jews, and they, we say in Yiddish, they were Christliche wie der Christ. They were more, they were Päupstliche wie der Päupst. They were more Pope than the Pope themselves. And they paid for it very, very badly because they were the first ones to go to the ovens. They really were the first ones. Very terrible thing that happened to them. But nevertheless, they remained German Jews with the same attitude as the Germans, the same culture, the same language. They didn't change. It was too late. Mm. Ah, Zionism.
Yes, the one of the main clubs hitting Yiddish over the head, being Zionism.
That was the second one. Zionism. Now, as I said, Zionism wanted Hebrew. They didn't want Yiddish. They were proclaiming a new Jew. When we get the state, we're going to have it build a new Jew from scratch. And they cut off their noses because no culture, no history, no creativity, everything that we created in the 2,000 years of exile, they cut off. So what kind of a Jew can you build from scratch? What country or people in the world built their own people from scratch? They had to have a mother, a father, a grandmother, a grandfather. There's no such thing as you build a person from scratch or a Jew. A Jew is not from scratch. A Jew comes with a long history. So they cut them their noses off. The next one was the assimilation. It did come from Germany first, and then it traveled to Poland, Russia, and Enlightenment. The Enlightenment introduced the Jews to the world. Creativity, literature, music, scholarship, science. I mean, it wasn't the Torah only. They couldn't live on the Torah alone. They needed enlightenment. So that also killed a lot. The Yiddish was out of their reach. They didn't want it. So that was the other clobbering on the head that Yiddish got. So that was the other was Bankeborn Kop, as we say. So all along, and then the Holocaust came. I'm not talking about the pogroms anymore. The Holocaust killed out 6 million Jews, of whom 3 million probably spoke Yiddish. And not only they killed 6 million Jews, but the new generations, they must have killed 50 million Jews this way, because there were no new generations coming after them, you see. So that was a death blow to Yiddish. And Israel did not allow Yiddish to be spoken or heard of again. So the Holocaust really did its job. Now, the Jews that remained in Gaulas, that remained in exile, American exile, which they don't feel that it's an exile. It's the best exile we ever had. We never had such a good exile as America. So we assimilate into this culture. I always accuse the Jewish Yiddish world of not worrying and not building a day school, a Yiddish day school, a seminar for teachers, Yiddish teachers, a kindergarten to college or to high school, like Canada did, like Mexico did, like Australia did. You know, all these, they built day schools and preserved Yiddish. America did not. So, the religious, when they came after the Holocaust, the first thing they did, they built yeshivas. One after the other. Yeshivas, the young, introduce them to religion, to God, to prayers. You know, this is the most important thing in Jewish religion. Our secular Jews did not worry about the young. They went into the American school system, wanted their children to become doctors and lawyers and engineers, learn the language, and so they killed the idea of a day school. Little did they know that if they would have built a Yiddish day school from the start, the doctors and the lawyers and the engineers would have been richer for it. They would come out richer for it, speaking two languages instead of one, English. And they killed the whole idea of Yiddish existence, you see. And so the elderly and the young ones that I have are ignorant of their backgrounds, of their culture, of their history, of their music, of their stories, of their folklore. They're all ignorant.
It sounds like what you're saying is a conflict. Yiddish, in a lot of ways, has been maybe a response, or at least existing in opposition to assimilation, nationalism. And now you have generations in America, and I come from Canada, but the doctors and lawyers drive exists there too, as a, on the whole, maybe not with all the Jewish community, but maybe especially, let's say, the Ashkenaz community that's been here for a longer time, that has more class privilege. So you
would ask me the question, if Israel, the state of Israel, would have had as a second language Yiddish, as a second language, what would they do with the Sephardic Jews that came in speaking Judeo-Arabic from Yemen, came from all these African countries and spoke their own dialects, their Arab traditions? They were Jewish Arab traditions. Mm-hmm. Their traditions, their music, their folklore, their holidays, their costumes, their celebrations. What happened to that? They cut that off too.
Sure.
So if you cut off your nose, they cut off their ears too. Mm-hmm. They have no right to cut that. Mm-hmm. It's very, very important to preserve, no matter what ethnic group the Jews belong to, you see. Mm-hmm. And that's what they keep saying. Well, we had the Sephardic Jews, so we couldn't speak Yiddish there. We couldn't. We could. And we could have taught Arabic also in the schools. In Switzerland and in Montreal, they speak four languages. And Sashatnish, nobody suffers from that.
It's actually a beautiful thing. I just came from Montreal. Actually, I just came from a restaurant. You could hear Arabic, Yiddish, Hebrew, French, Spanish. Everyone ordering smoothly. You've never seen such an efficient restaurant. thriving one. But it's,
that is the wonderful idea. And Jews were always inclined to it. They always spoke, whether it was Judeo-Yemenite, or it was Greek, Judeo-Greek. They spoke Latin or whatever. They spoke other languages also, and other cultures. They embraced other cultures. But there was always Judaism involved in it, you see. But I lived in Israel for 10 years, so I know what I'm talking about. And let me tell you something. The Yordim, the Yisraelim that leave Israel, and there are thousands upon thousands and thousands of them, and I meet them, they throw away their Hebrew like you throw away a shmata. Why? Because they were not attached to it as a cultural phenomenon, a language. They didn't have time to be attached to it. 50, 60 years is not enough to get attached to a language, its culture, its folklore, its music. Not enough, like Yiddish had. So they come, they throw it away. So what did they accomplish? What did they accomplish?
It's interesting contrasting that to, you know, this context we're in this week, where, like you said, there's a lot of people who only have threads of Yiddish, including myself, but yet want so much to weave it, want so much to make something out of a little, without nearly as much power, institutional, national influence. You know, these are people like yourself, teachers, people committed, but making it happen. You know, there's lots, like Kolia said, it's filled up here, you know, your classes are filled up, so... It's an interesting contrast.
I didn't speak Yiddish as a first language. I spoke Russian because I was born in Russia. So Russian was my primary language. But we escaped Russia right after the war. I was an 8-year-old. And we landed in Germany on the American zone in a DP camp, which is a displaced persons camp, a refugee camp. All the refugees, the Holocaust survivors, those that survived the Russian gulags and the concentration camps, And the children, we were children, we spoke different languages. Each one came with Romanian, Polish, Hungarian, and we couldn't communicate because the parents were afraid to speak Yiddish to them wherever they were during the war. My parents spoke Yiddish to me all the time, and I answered in Russian. The minute, like overnight, all the children, we, began speaking Yiddish to communicate. Because the parents began, they were free to speak Yiddish already to the children. So the entire camp spoke Yiddish.
So just to be clear, you're saying that there are people, Jews from all different parts of Europe who were in this camp who spoke both Yiddish and other sort of national language.
They didn't speak to their children during the war. They were afraid. They were afraid if they're caught. They were afraid if somebody, if they don't learn the language, the Russian, the Hungarian, Romanian, perfectly, and they'll detect a Yiddish expression or dialect or whatever. So they stopped speaking Yiddish to them. Like my parents spoke, they were not afraid. But I spoke Russian. I just didn't want to answer. But the minute we met, all these, we were a couple of hundred children in a camp that counted about 1,000 people. We suddenly began speaking to each other in Yiddish and communicating in Yiddish. Slowly, very slowly. The schools that we went to were Israeli cultural schools, Beit Sefer Tarbut. Not religion, there was no religion involved. There was also geography there, and nature, and math. But the problem was, our class, I had a class of 7-year-olds and 15-year-olds in the same class because it was temporary and they didn't have time to select the class. So, I mean, how much can you learn? I learned very little, but I did learn Hebrew, a little bit Hebrew. We were told never, ever to open our mouth and speak Yiddish. If they catch us to speak Yiddish, they will punish us. That was the school education. If we ever catch us speaking Yiddish, we'll punish you. You're going to come up to camp and see what we're speaking. We all spoke Yiddish. The teachers didn't know any Hebrew. They also spoke Yiddish, but they wouldn't dare. So they taught us like one word here, one sentence there. So the geography teacher knew a word. A4. He went around for 15 minutes A4ing, which means where? A4 Madagascar. So, not only didn't we know what's Madagascar, but he had A4. That A4 remained with me. I knew A4. See? So they didn't know any Hebrew either. Slowly, slowly they picked it up, but can you imagine math in Hebrew? We didn't know how to count.
So the Hebrew school wasn't even being taught in Hebrew. They just didn't want you speaking Yiddish.
Right. It was taught in Hebrew, but they wouldn't let us. They wouldn't even explain to us what's Madagascar.
If I can ask, you came with your mother to America?
My mother and my father.
And your father.
A full family, which was very unusual. Very few families survived the Russian Gulag and Siberia and the jails and the prisons and the camps, the slave labor camps. In one set, we survived as a set, my mother, my father, and I. So we came to America. I spoke Yiddish already, of course, Russian. I remember sitting on a windowsill in our new apartment in the Bronx, crying. "Why are you crying?" my mother wanted to know. I said, "I'm crying because of the Russian language. I'm going to forget this beautiful Russian word. I'm going to forget this beautiful Russian word." And I cried that every time I pronounced that word that I loved. And I cried. And I did forget him. I forgot him, but I cried. I cried. But I forgot. I still speak a little bit Russian. I can still speak a little. But I cried because I was forgetting it. But then a miracle happened. One of the girls living in my building where we moved in the Bronx went to a Yiddish shule. Now, who knew about a Yiddish shule? I didn't know about these things. I didn't know a lot of things. She said, "Come with me, you speak Yiddish. Come to Mittelschule. Come to Mittelschule." And I went with her to 14th Street. It was Roosevelt High School, I think. Oh, I don't remember. No, Washington Irving High School. Every weekend, Shabbos and Zuntik, we went to Yiddish school. Well, the teachers were magnificent. The literature was fantastic. For me, poetry, Itzhak Mangan, and Avrom Reisen, the people that I never heard of, the teachers were in love, especially my teacher Chaim Kashdan, in love with Itzhak Mangan. He was in love, I was in love. We both loved. Itzhak Mangan was still alive then, at that time. His poetry, his songs of paradise, his songs of the Chumash, his songs of Purim, the Megillah Lieder, and other poetry. It was heaven. So they introduced me. I was introduced to Yiddish poetry, Yiddish music, and Yiddish art, and Yiddish theater. It was heaven.
Can you paint that picture a little more? What did heaven look like?
Heaven looked like happiness. As a matter of fact, Itzhak Mangan wrote a book, which I'm teaching in Columbia, in chapters called The Book of Paradise. It's magnificent, magnificent. I'm teaching it in the original. The Book of Paradise, Buch von Gan Eden.
May I please?
And he describes what heaven looks like. Who lives there, how they live there, who deserves what, and looking forward to Mashiach, because they're already in heaven. They don't have to go to heaven. When Mashiach would come in, we're gonna slaughter the shorabor, the big ox that's being that is grazing in Gan Eden and filling up with fat and fat and fat. His meat is the fattest, the most. Who is going to eat that? The tzaddikim, all the righteous. And Avrom Avinu, our forefathers, Abraham and Yitzchak and Yankiv, all the mothers, our matriarchs. He describes what the heaven looks like, that the poor live very poorly. They are servants of these highfalutin, biblical figures. They cut their grass. They do their wings. They steal. They steal the cow, the little cow, because see, he has two friends that do all these things. One was Shmuel Abe and his friend Pishel. So Pishel, the little pisser. So these are the two friends. What they do there, they steal. He says, "I have a rich uncle and he has a goat. And he doesn't need it, he's rich. but your uncle is so poor, he's got tuberculosis. Let's steal the goat. The whole Ganeden is a shtetl. It's a shtetl. Everything that went on in shtetl goes on in Ganeden. So my Ganeden was the introduction to the language, really to the grammar, to the literature, to the history, not to the tradition, not to Hebrew, really. And I was missing that badly because I wanted to fulfill all these voids in my Yiddishkeit. I felt it because I came without religion. Russia did not allow any synagogues or religion or anything like that. So after I finished the seminary, the Mittelschul, I went to the Yiddish Teacher Seminary. And that was double Gan Eden, double Gan Eden. We had the most wonderful professors and teachers, psychology, sociology, in Yiddish everything, and world literature, Tolstoy, Dostoevsky, Dumas, Flaubert, French literature, German literature, Russian literature, in Yiddish, the entire Yiddish world literature in Yiddish. I was in seventh heaven. I read everything.
Mm-hmm. It was very impactful when you were describing the experience of coming and being worried about losing Russian, while you're also thrilled to be free, at least, to be speaking Yiddish at that time. What is that? I mean, I think it says a lot about what language means to you and your environment. And, can you elaborate on that a little more? Just because you're literally grieving, you know.
I am grieving.
And maybe still.
I knew Pushkin by heart as a child, as a five-year-old. I was introduced to Pushkin. And I knew him, Rybka, Rybake, Rybke, Skaska. Rybaki I Rybki, yeah, the golden fish, by heart. I knew poems, Pushkin's poems, by heart. I was still very young. I didn't get to the literature, really, but the children's literature. My father was at that time he had a press card, and he took me to theaters. Children's theaters.
Where was this?
In Russia, just before we escaped. Children's theater, Snezhnaya Korolyova. He took me to films, Cherevichki. He took me to the opera. I didn't understand anything, but Figaro, I think, or something like that. I didn't know anything. It was bombarding me from all sides, this music, this. And I loved the music, of course. I was crazy, crazy about the music. And another phenomenon is that in Germany, we children sang songs in four languages. We sang in Yiddish, we sang in Hebrew, we sang in Polish, we sang in Russian. The Russian songs were communist songs, the International, I, as a child, as a 10-year-old, wrote down all these songs, 80 songs, in four languages, in perfect handmanship, and I have it here, and the Holocaust Museum in Washington found out, I don't know how he found out that I have it, he came down, he interviewed me, and he said, "Sing!" I said, "I have no voice. I had a cold or something." "Sing." And I sang. So a woman that was doing an exhibit at DP camps, Lillian Gewirtzmann, she said, what else do you have here that would interest me?" He said, "Well, I can give you a scripted tape, you know, of a woman that sings these four languages, songs that she has an album." She said, "Sure." I was also in the same camps. in the same city. And she heard me. She said, who is this woman? I said, I'll give you a phone number. I gave her my phone number, and she looked me up. She was in Great Neck. And we met. We were in the same school together, in the same city together. We sang the same songs. We sat down and sang the songs once again. She sold the house in Great Neck and moved into my building. So we're friends for the last 5 years. You see. And it was a love affair. Language was a love affair for me. It didn't matter whether it was Russian or Yiddish. Once I discovered Yiddish, it was a love affair with Yiddish. And Hebrew, I loved Hebrew, especially the music. And Polish I didn't like, but I wrote down what we sang in Polish. Very interesting songs, by the way.